I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. Welcome to the show. Samantha and I are talking tonight with Maureen Metcalf, Metcalf and Associates. She's based out of Columbus, Ohio. She's the author of the Innovative Leadership Field Book, an award-winning book, and she's doing something very dynamic and innovative in and of itself. She's an organizational consultant, and she's going to talk to us about what innovative leadership actually is, and she's going to give us some examples of her own work. And how it ties in with our show is The Bridge to Everywhere is really, we're looking at the leading edge of holistic thinking, holistic thought, and how it really unfolds in economics and healthcare and politics and education. The more perspective, the more insights from as much information as we can actually take in, we're going to have a more appropriate response to the challenges we face. And Maureen's work is inspiring, and it really captures, because she's one of the first and very few leaders and organizational consultants that we've encountered who is really seeing this need at the level of the organization and has got real clear steps to help guide executives and organizational leaders to really meet the challenges of today.
So before we bring Maureen in, I just want to give you a little bit of an idea of some of her accomplishments and read a brief bio, and then we'll invite her to start talking. So Maureen Metcalf, she's the president of Metcalf and Associates Incorporated. She's a distinguished leader, consultant, speaker, and teacher focused on helping leaders transform themselves and their organizations in service of creating healthy, sustainable, and successful organizations. She's the co-author of the Innovative Leadership Field Book, published by Integral Publishing in 2012, and it was the Best Business Reference Book winner in the International Award and of the Innovative Leadership Workbook Series. She's developed, tested, and implemented emerging models that dramatically improve how clients transform themselves and their organizations, solving the most challenging problems and building thrivability, which I can't wait to talk about thrivability. Maureen's coaching and consulting areas of expertise include leadership assessment and development, leadership coaching, organizational assessment, leadership and organizational transformation workshops, organizational transformation consulting, and public speaking on topics of leadership and transformation. Maureen combines intellectual rigor and discipline with an ability to translate leading-edge theory into practice to serve all of her clients. She designs and teaches MBA classes in leadership and organizational transformation at Capital University. She was a finalist for the Tech Columbus Innovation Award Women of the Year in Technology 2007 and semifinalist in 2012. As a senior manager with two Big Four management consulting firms for 12 years, Maureen managed and contributed to a successful completion of a wide array of projects, from strategy development and organizational design for startup companies to large system change for well-established organizations. She worked with a number of Fortune 100 clients, delivering a wide range of significant results, such as increased profitability, cycle time reduction, increased employee engagement and effectiveness, and improved quality. Wow, that's quite a bio. And this is actually a momentous occasion for a lot of reasons. First, it's amazing to have somebody with the experience that Maureen has on the show. But I want to point out, Maureen is our first call-in guest. So we're actually speaking to her in Ohio. Isn't that cool? In Palmer, Alaska.
It's great. And welcome to the show, Maureen.
Thank you, Kevin and Sam. Both. I'm delighted to be here, and I didn't realize I was your first call-in guest.
Yep.
That's really cool.
You are number one.
Yeah, I mean, we plan to bring in more and more folks from out of state and maybe even out of the country, and we also want to show how the local resources that we have here are globally relevant, and so that, you know, we are increasing our audiences. It's not just Alaska, it's the lower 48 states, and also we do have listeners out in Europe as well. And so there's this really amazing time in history right now where people at the local level and the innovators here can actually reach out and make an impact globally, and then of course we can bring folks like you into our community.
Right, so we're saying local is the new global.
Or they're not.
And if you could give us a little bit of an introduction on how you got into training people in innovative leadership, and then we'll get a little bit more into what actually innovative leadership is.
I guess it started as I was working 15 years ago on organizational transformation projects, and we were really good at flowcharting, you know, drawing pictures with sticky notes and all that stuff. We weren't so good at translating what we put on paper into changed behavior. And so I really set out at that point to understand how humans actually change. So I took a job with one of the large consulting firms in their change management practice, which was a good foundation, and taught me about the systems that we put in place to help people change. But it didn't really get to the underlying motivations of real people and how they make sense of the world, so their meaning-making. And it's the meaning-making that I think is the real differentiator in looking at how do we lead and how do we understand our stakeholders in a more nuanced way so that we can help them drive the changes that they're trying to see in the world and that we're trying to see in the world. So getting back to that thrivability, that as the world's changing, we've got to transform our organizations at the right pace to keep up and, in the best case, stay ahead of those clients whose needs we're trying to meet and our competition if we're trying to be more profitable.
Could you say maybe a little bit more just about the context in which organizations are operating now? What are the challenges that leaders are facing that really put the pressure for this kind of individual transformation and personal change?
So you talked about globalization, and I think that's one of the keys, and the other is technology, right? So it wasn't that long ago that I just started using email. Well, it was a long time ago. But, you know, at some point, the pace that we operated within was significantly slower. So we brought products to market at a slower rate. Our competition was those people in our local community. I wasn't competing with people globally. And now I am. A friend of mine started a clothing design and distribution firm. She works from her home. She's working with people. Her manufacturers are in China, and she's distributing around the world. And that just didn't happen 10 or 15 years ago, where I could start a little cottage industry and employ people globally and distribute globally. So I think the level of complexity is the country of Iceland went bankrupt in large part when the U.S. Collapse happened in 2008. Again, that level of global interconnection and technology is just accelerating the pace and injecting a lot of uncertainty into systems that were relatively stable, and now we're having to react much more quickly. So the shortening of response time is also really impacting our ability to predict and manage. And now we're having to react to the world in a very different way.
So there's a couple of things about what you said that I thought was interesting. One was the example that you gave of the woman who's starting this business out of her house, and she's, you know, like using global distributors. You think of something, what she's doing, you know, like you said, you couldn't have done 15 years ago. You'd think that would require a large company. So in some ways, because of the technology that's out there, an individual or a handful of people can do things that would have required a large company to do. And if you're a large company and all of a sudden you have people kind of eating up your market share because they can do things faster and they're quicker and they can, you know, and they can sort of come up with new ideas and move around things, if you don't stay relevant as a large company, you're not going to be around for very long, correct?
Absolutely correct. The level of agility required is phenomenal, and large companies that for lots of good reasons have significant overhead are, as you point out, are now competing with relatively small companies with little to no overhead. And the consumer has to see the value or the value proposition for spending the extra money, or the company's profit drops significantly.
And the other thing that you brought up a little bit earlier was about what it takes to get people to change, that you can put everything on paper and so things look really good. One of the ways I've heard that described is just because you can fit it all in your day planner doesn't mean you can actually do it. So thinking about the in terms of like what is the difference between having a great plan and actually implementing that and actually making it work and getting the people in the organization to live up to whatever the values of the organization are and to do things differently and to actually like grow and change and push their edges. That seems to me mean that's the real trick right there, because again, you can come up with all of these wonderful ideas about how things should look, but if nobody in the organization is willing to do things differently, you're not going to actually end up with something different.
And the reasons they do things differently are vastly different across populations, right? So it depends on your culture and your values and your comfort with change. So there are some people who are thrill seekers and they do extreme sports and they're probably much more comfortable with change. There are other people who don't, and their willingness to experiment is pretty low. And so how do we understand those populations and put plans in place that meet them where they are instead of just, you know, reciting the old, the bus is pulling out of the station and if you don't get on it, we're going to run you over? Not helpful.
Right.
So in your work, do you have various types and orientation and maybe the different value structures that are people's most comfortable reference point and be able to identify them and then also create an environment where they can be groomed?
So I look at a couple of different things. One is personality type. The second is developmental level. And the developmental level really captures the way we make sense of the world. So at some levels, we are less comfortable with change. We want to get things right. So it's a fairly black and white way of looking at the world. So in some people are familiar with the term spiral dynamics. And so at earlier levels in the spiral, so think of a seashell and how on the inner levels, the circle is much smaller, and as it spirals out, we have a much greater level of complexity in our thinking and longer time horizon and also more comfort with making mistakes and change. So at the earlier levels, people just want to get things right. So as those leaders and people helping helping our constituents and our users and our stakeholders make sense of change, we have to be fairly concrete and absolute in what they need to do to successfully transform. And so I need to understand as the leader who is at that earlier level and be very concrete. If I treat someone who's an executive the same way, they throw me out the window. So really understanding those stakeholder groups and everything from the language I use to the granularity to the concreteness of a description of how we want to implement a change has to be vastly different across those groups. Is that?
Yeah, that's great. And it makes just complete sense that that level of specificity is going to actually produce a much better result, where people are actually being addressed much more closely to reality, to where they're actually at.
Yeah, I think a lot of times the idea you know we have as leaders is that if we just set the bar to a certain level that people will want to rise up to it. But if their focus is, you know, and I guess what you would call like the inner part of that spiral, if they're really just focused on I just want to do it right, I just want to do a good job, but they don't really have the bigger picture in mind, you might actually be setting that person up to fail.
We are setting them up to fail or just not perform. So if I make sense of the world by how well I perform, then if you put me in a situation where I'm not going to be able to succeed, I may just do nothing or very little. So my way of surviving is do less. So the way I, as a leader, meet those people who just want to get it right is give very clear, concrete instructions, make accessible reference cards and instructions, not go read the 500-page instruction manual, but kind of a how do I condense things to quick reference cards on a sheet, how do I offer training and practice sessions, and how do I do things in smaller chunks. So if I'm going to implement a six-step process, how can we maybe teach people a couple steps at a time, have them make those changes, and then add to it, where, again, with someone at a higher level of complexity, I can give them all of the changes that they need to implement, and over a weekend they'll go figure it out.
So on that lower level, just and as you break down the steps into smaller chunks, as they succeed in each one of those steps and they feel like they've done it right, that actually is the motivation to move forward and do more?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, if I'm motivated by getting it right, then as long as I'm doing it right, I can take on something else.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to know that I have the support and the practice time to get it right.
Now, can somebody on that level, you know, as a leader, I'm assuming in your organization, you're always looking to help people move up to the next level. So is there a certain point where when you're making assessments as a leader that, well, this person, that this is just the, this is where the person's at, and I don't really see that this person's going to move beyond that, so, but I'm still going to treat them according to where they're at? Or is there a way in which you go, okay, well, this person is at the level of I just want to get it right, but I see some potential where they can move into this next way of thinking? Is that something that you do in innovative leadership?
I absolutely look at who can move, but I also need to respect that people are where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And just because I want them to move doesn't mean they should. It's really a personal choice. So I've taken a job at an entry-level role, and if my priority isn't moving up within the organization, then I might be happy doing my job, doing it exceedingly well, going home at 5 o'clock and having a more balanced life. And I get to make that choice. So I have had clients say, yep, I get what it takes to develop. It's not where I am in life right now. It's not my priority. So that's nice stuff. Count me out.
But that's good to know, you know, so that you're not banging your head against the wall trying to get somebody to change,
right,
who's basically perfectly happy where they're at. You know, not everybody wants to change and grow and develop. So I think that's a really interesting point, that if you're pushing people to do something because you want them to do it, but that's not really where they're at, then that's going to create some friction in your organization.
Friction with me and friction with them, right? Because by inferring that someone should live my values, I'm kind of disrespecting their life choices.
Exactly.
Not everyone wants to be me. Lots of people don't want to be me.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want to just get a little clarity. So as we're looking at the various elements of innovative leadership as you train in your model, and I mentioned briefly the leader type, and I think that's tied into the Enneagram, and I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, and then maybe just a little more distinction between that and the aspect of developmental perspective that we've just been talking about, and then where that leads.
So if we think of leader types, think of the horizontal axis, and we all are born with a personality type. So the one that most people are familiar with is Myers-Briggs. So things like introverted and extroverted, sensing and feeling, perceiving and judging. So the MBTI is one set of tools. Other people have used DISC. I use the Enneagram. So it really looks at my personality type. And most we come into the world with a type, and we don't generally change our personality type, although some people would report that they have. Mostly the theory says we don't. Developmental level then is the vertical axis. So as I move up the vertical axis, my personality will seem different. And by that I mean I'm less controlled by those personality-related characteristics. So if I'm an introvert, I can manage it differently. I manage it. It doesn't control me. So... Go ahead.
Well, would you say you're also in that, as you move up the developmental level, though, you still, according to your personality type, you still have specific strengths and weaknesses, so you're working with those things better, you're able to manage the weaknesses better, and you're actually able to utilize your strengths better at the same time?
I think that's absolutely correct. And the point isn't to be a different person. It's to be more effective at who we are.
Mm.
Right? So there are things I will never do. I wasn't born as a gymnast. I'll never be a gymnast. For someone to say that I should be a gymnast would be ridiculous. Similarly, I have a set of strengths that just are innate to my personality type, and I should leverage those and not try to be something that is innately not probable.
Can we talk just a little bit about what those personality types are? I know we can't go into them all in depth, but just sort of give a list of what those are.
Sure. So the Enneagram looks at 9 different types, and I know there are lots of different perspectives on personality typing and is it helpful and not helpful and all that stuff. And one of the things I'll say in a leadership setting is there's some good doctoral research on using the Enneagram in an organizational setting, and specifically why it's helpful is that we all understand the way we talk about type, and we have a common language. So part of it is just understanding our uniquenesses and creating a common language. And one of the things that, and I will probably reiterate this often, at the earlier developmental level, we tend to think that people are all like us, and if you're not like me, there's probably something wrong with you.
Got it.
So even something as simple as a typing tool helps us start to understand that if people behave differently, it may be because they're basically wired differently. It's not because they're broken or they're mean or they're uncooperative. They're just unique. And so it helps, as we look at how do you move through the levels, one of the earlier capacities is to start to understand uniquenesses and differentiate. Because at the earlier levels, we think everyone's the same.
So that seems like that alone can create some space, right? Because you have, if a lot of people are, a lot of people get frustrated because, well, why doesn't that person act the way I want them to act?
And it seems like it would also take a lot of the personal grievances out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everything is so personal sometimes in the workplace where, you know, do you believe this person said such and such? But if you begin to appreciate the different archetypes or just the different orientations, it's not personal. It's just the way they're actually wired. I think that does create a lot of space.
It's huge. So an example, I was teaching this to a group of nursing students, and nurses stereotypically tend to be helpers. So if they're working with somebody who's a challenger, the challenger will typically, by their nature, tend to push back on things. And so if I'm trying to be helpful and you keep pushing back on me and then you happen to be in pain because you're ill, that orientation toward pushing back is going to be even accelerated. So the fact that somebody is seeming to you to be mean may in fact be their default style, and they don't dislike you. It's just how they behave. So let me run through the 9 types.
And can you also say before you, is there, just spell Enneagram so people know the word that we're saying, and if there's a website where you can go, you know, if it's like Enneagram.com, just so people know, and then let's go through the types.
It's Enneagram, and I would Google the Enneagram Institute.
Great.
And also Riso and Hudson are the authors of the textbook that I tend to use. So now I'm wanting to see if there's, off the top of my head, I don't remember. Oh, yeah, it is www.enneagraminstitute.com.
Great. Perfect. So, yeah, so let's go into the 9 personality types.
Okay, so the first is the reformer. They're rational and idealistic. So at the best, they're wise, discerning, realistic, and noble, and can be morally heroic. They also tend to be fairly rule-bound and at their worst can be a bit judgmental.
Great.
Okay.
The second type is the helper, caring and interpersonal. At their best, they're unselfish, altruistic, to want to help landscape other people's yards.
That's great.
Is she good at it?
She had a truckload of mulch delivered to
Whoa.
The neighbor. She had no concept of how big a truckload was. So now she has this mulch delivered to somebody's front yard. It's now killing their grass. And she's got to figure out what to do with this truckload of mulch. So she literally got her little wheelbarrow out and mulched the yards of, like, 9 neighbors.
Oh.
Wow.
So as much as she wants to be helpful, imagine her being your boss. She can step in places where she's not necessarily wanted. Many of the neighbors might find her to be a little overbearing.
You're reminding me of a Marlo Thomas song from the album Free to Be You and Me, and it's Some Kind of Help is the Kind of Help that that's helping's all about, and Some Kind of Help is the Kind of Help we all can
do
without.
And so, yeah, the helper overdone will be in your yard in the middle of the night planting things or digging stuff.
Right. So,
okay, just...
Maureen, we've got about 2.5 minutes
here. So we
can
do one more, and then we'll take a break, and we'll get into the other six.
Okay, the third is the achiever, and they're very success oriented and pragmatic. So self accepting, authentic, and they're role models who can inspire others. I will say I am this type, which can also be workaholic, overzealous, expecting people to respond immediately. We can get lots done, and for people who aren't us, I'm sure we can seem incredibly overbearing in our expectations.
Wow. You know, a lot of this is, you can see it's immediately applicable. It's immediately usable information. I think it's fascinating. You can just imagine a workplace where this is really appreciated and understood. It could become a much more exciting place to work.
It also helps us be much more compassionate with ourselves and others, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I realize my style can be overbearing, and when I run into somebody who's different, it's an invitation to me to back it down and appreciate their unique talents, because there are lots of things that I'm not good at that they bring to the organization.
And I think one of the things you gave us a quote from something called Deep Living by Roxanne Howe Murphy, and you said most of us have a concept about how we behave, but that idea is likely clouded and not entirely true. One of the hardest things for most people to see themselves accurately. So I think we'll take a break on that note, and we'll come back and finish up the last six types in the Enneagram,
and then we'll get a little bit more into some other elements of innovative leadership.
Great.
Yeah. Thanks,
okay.
Maureen.
You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere with Sam and Kevin, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial. If you'd like to get involved with community radio, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Chickaloon, Butte, Palmer, and the surrounding areas.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Bridge to Everywhere. Before we get started, we're in a conversation with Maureen Metcalf of Metcalf & Associates, based in Columbus, Ohio. And we're talking about innovative leadership. And before we get back into the conversation, I just want to encourage everyone, if you really enjoy this content and excited to be a part of Radio Free Palmer, and if you live in the Palmer area, or even beyond, you can become a member. Just go to our website, radiofreepalmer.org. There's various levels of membership, but boy, every little bit helps. And it's fun to participate in something like this that really, I really feel like this kind of community radio and the impact that it can make globally and locally is just extraordinary. So be a part of it. Sign up for a membership. It doesn't cost much, and we sure appreciate it.
And you can just run upstairs in the downtown Palmer Plaza and stick a check underneath the door. You don't even have to say anything to anybody, and it will be greatly appreciated.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, Maureen, we were talking about the various leader types from the Enneagram model. So maybe just finish those up.
And just before you go, there's nine different personality types in the Enneagram, and we went over three. So could you just mention the first three again? You don't have to explain them. Just say those three again, and then we'll move into number four.
Sure. Type one is the reformer. Type two is the helper. Type three is the achiever.
Okay, which is what you are. So we're talking to an achiever. Just want to put those brackets around you. We're talking to an achiever. Okay, so number four is what?
Is the individualist. It's a sensitive, withdrawn type. So there are some types who are very forward, and there are others who are more withdrawn. And you know, here's part of the dynamic, right? If we're a forward type, and we encounter someone who's withdrawn, we can take it personally. They don't like us or, you know, whatever. And in fact, it's, again, just the way they're wired. So at their best, the individualist is inspired, highly creative, and able to renew themselves and transform their experience. They tend to be extremely, extremely creative types. But the withdrawnness and the introspection, and which can border on moody. So in my negative side, if I'm a type 4 or an individualist, if I am moody, other people can interpret that in a way that is not helpful.
So this person is not necessarily the team player in the organization, but they may be coming up with really great ideas that other people need to implement?
And they are absolutely as committed to the organization. Mm-hmm. They're just more withdrawn in their behavior.
Got it.
So it's important to distinguish that, almost like I'm introverted or extroverted, my care for the organization doesn't change, and my commitment to excellence and my performance doesn't change. It's just the way I express it is different. And as a society, we tend to be a bit more of an achiever society that's more extroverted. So we interpret people who are not that as less positive or good or committed or whatever words we want to put to it. And I think that's part of the value of this tool is just because I show up differently doesn't mean I'm any less involved or caring. So I'm working with a client right now who runs a radio station, and there's one gentleman who shows up at work at 3 a.m, so it's not surprising that withdrawn people
want the night shift.
The 3 a.m. shift. but there's another person on the staff who just interprets his withdrawnness as rude and unacceptable behavior, and in fact he's just extremely introverted, and his way of expressing care is through the creativity he brings to his work, not through his bubbliness, which he just isn't.
Right. And so you're pointing out a cultural bias, which is what we put our emphasis on in this culture. You know, that we think everybody should, again, like everybody should be up and out and going and doing and stuff. But other people, I think that was an interesting way to say it, that other people express their care for the organization in different ways. So what I think that looks like might not be what somebody else is thinking that looks like. But that doesn't mean that we both don't care about the organization.
And again, as a leader, it's absolutely critical to be able to differentiate when someone's a non-performer versus just back to what you started with, I understand my strengths and mm-hmm. I express them appropriately. As a leader, I need to understand your strengths and your type and bring out the best in you and not expect you to look like me.
Got it. Okay, so moving on to number 5, or do you have a question?
Yeah, well, I was just going to add a little insight here. So if I remember, if we go back to the developmental perspective, this vertical axis, then one becomes less maybe limited by these particular orientations. They, like, I can still be an introvert, but I have a greater capacity to appreciate the complexity of the office environment. I'm going to be less likely to be driven by these maybe these pre-thought orientations, you know, habitual ways of seeing. I can see more, and mm-hmm. I can maybe respond with a broader range of behaviors and insights and ideas in the organization. Is that putting it together right?
Absolutely perfectly. Yeah, I have a much broader range, even though my preferred approach may be introversion. I am able to function much better in an extroverted culture than I did at an earlier developmental level.
Great. Okay, so yeah, continue
number
on with
five.
The, yeah, number 5.
Okay, so this is the investigator. They're intense cerebral types. At their best, they're visionary pioneers, often ahead of their time, and able to see the world in entirely new ways. So these are theorists, extremely cognitive. So a friend of mine is still is this type. If this is somebody with whom I would go out to dinner, and his idea of a great evening was doing a crossword puzzle and not talking to me.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
For me, not helpful. For him, perfect evening. So again, it's easy to take that non-conversation as personal. And in fact, this is, again, this is somebody whose GMAT scores were the highest of any, when he took the GMAT, the highest score anyone had ever gotten. Some of these people are just off the charts brilliant. They're just not as, what's going on in his head was much more interesting than anything I could have ever said. And so his way of interacting with the world is often in his own thoughts and less outward. And yet when he is outward, he's brilliant. You know, this is somebody who is solving big problems in the world.
So I would think that somebody like that is seeing things like they're sort of a level above the average person. So they're often seeing things that other people can't necessarily see. And the people maybe below the level where they're acting are maybe just not interesting to them because they're looking, they're so high up almost that they can't even see what's going down below, going on below them. Is that correct?
I think that's true in many cases. Now, I'm sure there were type fives who were also of normal intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, these people are able to put together theories and models and constructs in often new and innovative ways. So their world is a world of thoughts. And the same person would was interested in sports and betting and often won what do you call those things? Obviously, I'm not a person of sports and betting.
Wagers, bets,
gamblers,
gambler, yeah, or odds. You're talking about like betting, like knowing everything that goes into the who creates the odds, like betting on.
Yeah,
That's what we're talking about. Yeah, we're obviously not gamblers.
The odds maker, or something.
But you're basically saying somebody who could run the numbers and figure out, you know, what was it, even though it was that they were going to make a significant amount of money, maybe betting on the underdog or something like that.
Able to understand odds and. Mm-hmm. And nuances that most people don't see.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the thing that's interesting about this is this is a person who lives in their head, and their withdrawnness can often be seen as antisocial or isolation or eccentric. And it's, again, an orientation around, it's how I'm wired. So this is not a person who should be a party planner.
What kind of party would you end up with that person?
You hand everyone either betting sheets or crossword puzzles.
Uh-huh.
And it would be you would walk in the room and it would be a quiet party.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So what's number six?
Oh, was that six?
That was five.
That was five, right? Okay.
I think so, right? Yeah.
Yes, that was five.
We're number six. Okay.
Six is the loyalist. So they're committed, security-oriented type. At their best, they're internally stable and self-reliant, courageous, and championing self and others. So reliable, hardworking, responsible, security-oriented, and trustworthy. So I had a client who is this type. He was a chief information officer, extremely dedicated to our CEO. What that ended up looking like for him, which was less fortunate, is as the company went through a lot of distress, he ended up not picking up on the cues that would have encouraged him to leave, and he just stayed too long.
Hmm.
Because of that, just the driving force for him was loyalty.
So he's going to go down with the ship.
Yep.
Got it.
He is absolutely go down with the ship kind of guy.
Okay. And what's number seven?
Seven is the enthusiast. So busy, fun-loving, focusing talents on worthwhile goals, becoming appreciative, joyous, and satisfied. So this is the person, if you wonder if you're a type seven, if you have every night on your calendar scheduled with, like, three different events, you might be an enthusiast. So almost the opposite of a type 5 who probably doesn't have many social events on their their calendar.
So
the enthusiast is bouncing between party to party.
And this would probably be also a person that might commonly overcommit themselves, you know, maybe be involved in a little too many projects. Is that accurate?
Yes. Or? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if not managed properly, may have trouble delivering results.
That makes it, because like a lot, beginnings are fun, but follow through is maybe not so strong.
Yeah, because everything is exciting, right?
Right.
So I want to I want to participate in every single project.
And there's only so many hours in the day. And
I think you might have just been talking to the two of us.
Maybe the three of us. I don't know. There's our technician, Alex, here. We're all looking at each other laughing.
What are we not doing, right?
Okay. Yep, reality is we're all on the phone, so there is a level of follow-through.
There you go.
Okay, so what's number eight?
So let me say one more thing about the type 7. At the earlier developmental levels, when not managing it, I don't follow through. At the later developmental levels, I start to understand that I get excited by every project, and I manage my enthusiasm in a way that allows me to say, okay, I can't do that,
mm-hmm.
or I need to negotiate what I'm able to deliver. So, again, we start to manage our innate quality and our preference to participate in everything and do it in a way that is extremely productive.
And so this, the way you're speaking about it, I think it's worth noting that what you're talking about it from an empowerment perspective. You're not talking about it from, this is my personality type, this is what I'm stuck with, these are my strengths, these are my weaknesses, and I'm just like this because, and I'm not going to change. You're talking about really just that statement that I said before the break, really trying to understand and see what are your unique gifts, what are your unique strengths and weaknesses, you know, what, like getting an idea of what kinds of troubles am I going to run into in an organization given that I'm like this, and then transcending those things and keeping and moving those strengths along with you so that you can contribute to the highest ability that you can, and also not being limited by your weaknesses. So you know you have a weakness, but you know you have a weakness, and you're going to be able to manage it so that it's actually in service of your strengths in a way.
Yeah, and the way I'm seeing this is that this vertical component just gives life. It's the engine of innovation, because without it, you get a flatland.
Yeah, without it, I'm a victim. And with the vertical capacity, I can manage both strengths and weaknesses, and I am no longer a victim of any of this.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Just a nuance.
Yep. Okay, so we got two more. We got 8 and 9.
Yep. So 8 is the challenger. It's the powerful, dominating type. So it's again, a forward type. I'm self-mastering, and I use my strengths to improve others' lives, becoming heroic, magnanimous, and inspiring. This is also the person that I work with a colleague who is like this, and no matter what I say, she says no.
That sounds like fun, too. I think I'd rather go out to dinner with the guy with
the crossword puzzle.
I'd rather have the blank stare than the no.
It's an immediate pushback. It is everything you say. There's an immediate pushback. Why I'm wrong. And then we work through it, and we come to an agreement, and she always has good ideas. But again, if I take it personally, there's this pushback to everything. It just feels like everything is a challenge, hence challenger. So it's wonderful to have somebody who encourages me to think more deeply and really question my own beliefs and values and assumptions and everything, from my clothing choice to my hair color. And it can be tiring. So both are concurrently true. And again, think back to our nurse example, where the challenger is continually pushing back, and for them, that's a natural state of being. It's not being aggressive, but to people who are not that, it can feel extremely aggressive.
And so besides not taking it personally, what's the best way to handle a challenger if you have one in your organization?
You know, meet that energy with the same energy. They like people to push back on them.
Mm.
That's how they relate to the world. So one of my closest friends is Italian. Actually, a couple of the folks I know who are challengers are Italian. And she would just say, that's just our Italian heritage. We just talk loud and we push back on people.
And so you meet that energy with the same level, and then it's like the analogy I'm coming up with is you can sort of play ping pong with them. Like you push back and forth until you get somewhere, but it's not personal on either side.
No, and to them it's not disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To other personality types, it's rude and inconsiderate. To a challenger, they want someone to, I'm alive if people are pushing back on me. I'm engaged if people are pushing back on me.
Yeah, so.
Otherwise, they're wimpy and like, why am I talking to you? Yeah, I don't know you.
That makes sense.
Okay, and then the next type is very different. It's the peacemaker, easygoing, self-effacing, all-embracing, able to bring people together and heal conflicts. So think of the challenger. I push back on everybody. And the peacemaker, I kind of don't push back on people. And how does the peacemaker see the challenger as obnoxious? And the challenger sees the peacemaker probably as wimpy.
As wimpy, yeah.
So it is through my understanding of different types that I can develop an appreciation for there are certain things in my organization that a peacemaker is just the right person. So I work with a CEO who's a peacemaker. So it's not, he's not wimpy at all. He's extremely talented. He just is not that, again, the stereotypical Lee Iacocca or, you know, the folks we think about on the news as big company CEOs. He's not that. He's extremely caring and thoughtful and deliberate, and his people are amazingly dedicated to him. So I don't mean to paint the peacemaker as wimpy. It's just they can be misinterpreted and underestimated. And it would be a huge loss to underestimate someone for personality type who is incredibly talented, just not as aggressive or outgoing.
Wow. So do you, in your training, do you walk your students, the folks you're training, through this ability to identify types and then exercises perhaps in trying to engage various types so they develop skills and versatility with a full range?
I do. So I'm working right now with an engineering company, and we break the types into three different groups. So initiators, cooperators, and soloists. So our initiators are the eights, the threes, and the sevens. So the challenger, the achiever, and the enthusiast. And so that group starts talking very quickly, and they get through the exercise like in 3 minutes. They don't do it very thoroughly, but they're done.
Let's just get this done so we can move to the next thing.
Yeah, and then they leave the room, and they're wandering around the building, and they're doing something in the parking lot, and they're checking their email, and they're making phone calls. The cooperators are the second type. Those are the reformers, the helpers, and the loyalists. And they want time to kind of figure things out and understand it and understand the framework and understand the expectations and the rules and guidelines. And these are people who go behind the initiators and actually make sure that stuff gets done. And then the third group is the soloists. Those are the more withdrawn types. So the four, the five, which is the individualist, the investigator, and the peacemaker, and they will tend to spend more time independently. And so that group is incredibly quiet. So in a room, when you break folks into these three groups, just watching the deliberations and the interactions and the volume of the different groups is funny. Because one group is done and out of the room. They're just missing. In this engineering company, many of them are the loyalists. So they're all over there trying to figure things out and being very deliberate about their process. And then the soloists are just quiet. And in that company, there were fewer of them. And in a corporate setting, it seems like there are often fewer of the soloists in the leadership ranks. But again, not to underestimate that there are some amazingly talented people in that soloist rank. So then it is helping the group of leaders understand that we, the initiators, jump in and we're loud and we make progress. And if we don't encourage the soloists to participate, we miss a bunch of the brain trust.
Right.
And same with the cooperators. If I miss, so the soloist has this investigator type, so I miss some of the greatest synthesis in thinking if I'm moving too fast and I don't slow down to encourage them, because they're going to be quieter. So as a leader, how do I integrate these different personality types and ensure that everyone's involved, or as an organization, we lose?
That's great. So, I mean, I'm really getting a sense now of how how these various aspects need to come together to get a well-running machine as a company that really works well, strong teams, everybody doing what they do best, doing it well, and doing it together. And I'm kind of wondering now about the overall context in which that's happening and the value structures and vision that's actually encompassing the company. So the people very much at the top are there. Now, I think if there's time, you know, we maybe have about 7 more minutes. Is there anything to say about that in terms of the very top of the leadership and cultivating a perspective that is really forward-leaning into this time in history where, I mean, I feel like that companies that are going to be real leaders, that are going to be successful, have an orientation to solve global problems in the process of becoming excellent at what they do, that to be really relevant and to be really effective, that in some way this broader perspective and deeper values need to be governing the companies.
I absolutely agree. And so that moves us into this concept of developmental levels. So at the later levels, and I know we don't have much time to talk about this, there were some characteristics that I would look for. So things we look at when we assess people are the level of cognitive complexity or thinking complexity, but it's much bigger than IQ. It's also my ability to take other people's perspectives, so understanding who you are and what you stand for. My ability to be emotionally intelligent and to behave in a way that demonstrates grace.
What does emotional intelligence look like? Could you speak to that a little bit more?
Sure. I'm aware of it. It's one thing to dispel. It's not touchy-feely. Mm-hmm. So I am aware of my own inner process, and I manage it effectively. So it could be anything from people who are not emotionally intelligent, when they have an incident driving, can ruin their day, right? So they shoot somebody, and then that ruins everyone's day. So right, something happens, I get flustered, and I then run around the rest of the day being angry and taking that frustration out on somebody else, because I'm not effectively managing and shifting those emotions.
So you could say it's, I think, emotional intelligence, the way I'm hearing you say it, is like there's a certain amount of space between what you're experiencing and the experiencer. So you can see it. You're not in it all the way. You get some perspective, and you also have the ability to bear that discomfort so that you don't feel like you need to share it with others. Does that make sense?
And the discomfort doesn't own you. You mm-hmm. own it.
Oh,
yes.
You can choose differently, right? So something happens to me driving to work, and I can spend the rest of the day angry, or I can step back and say, boy, that was unfortunate, but that's not going to ruin my day. I'm not going to go home and yell at my family because traffic was bad. That's ridiculous.
Right, and just because you feel something, I think often we've kind of gone the way in our culture that because we have a feeling, we feel like that means we need to express it. And so to realize that not just because you have a feeling or a thought doesn't mean it needs to be expressed. And I think we went from a certain point in our cultural development where everybody was stoic and didn't express, and there was a lot of self-expression that was encouraged, and now we've gone maybe a little bit too far to the other side where every single thought and feeling people feel like they're not being authentic if they're not expressing it. And I would say that authenticity is more about what are your values and are you living up to those values based on your actions, not that you're expressing every single thought and feeling that you have so everybody knows exactly what's going on in your process.
And I mean, think about what an organization that would be, you know, if the, you know, the top tier executives are really taking themselves on in this way. I mean, oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I talk about it. So an example is something goes wrong. I don't want my executives to be so authentic that they're going to go jump off the roof of the building, right? I really don't want to know as an executive that you're terrified. I want to know that you think it's serious and that we will find a way forward and we've got the right people in the room. So there is a level of management. So I talked about my Type 9 peacemaker CEO. He during the downturn in 2008, he needed to let some people go, and he was devastated by this. He still can hardly talk about it without tearing up. But yet he needed to be publicly facing strong. So it's not about suppressing our emotions. It's about managing them in a healthy way. And I think there's a big difference between I just stick them in a box and act like they don't exist, or I process them by myself in an appropriate way with somebody I care about, but I don't run around oversharing. So that's to the point that if I'm being authentic, I'm tweeting about it. No. Right? There's a level of professionalism and decorum that are required at a certain level in an organization. And oversharing is not doing that.
Yeah, and suppression doesn't work either because it's going to come out somewhere. You can't just stuff forever. It's going to affect, you know, either affects your physical health or it affects your mental health or it gets taken. It isn't ever just shoved down. It always ends up somewhere and causes a problem. So it's better to deal with it effectively in the moment. And, you know, there's some middle ground between overexpressing and over-suppressing, I imagine.
And so there are a set of tools to help us manage those.
That's great.
And it is developing a level of mastery in understanding it and processing it so that I can function effectively.
Well, I can really see where this is just this is the future of organizational development. I mean, it really is. I mean, this level.
We're going to need to do a part
two because we are running out of time here. But maybe say a few things about your book and how people can follow up with you to learn more. And we're just
and
in the
we'll
last.
We'll definitely have
here.
You back on.
Thank you. So there are a couple of different ways to access the book. The first is the Innovative Leadership Field book, and that goes into much more detail on types and developmental perspectives and the whole innovative leadership construct. And that frankly is my favorite book. It's used in several graduate programs, and I teach in an MBA program and use it in mine. We developed a workbook series as a companion to that for people who are frankly busy and not inclined to read the heavier, heavy being 250 pages. It's not a 700-page book.
Mm-hmm.
But for folks who want to read about innovative leadership in an article that's like the size of a Harvard Business Review article, the workbooks are the more appropriate tool. And then part of what I really like about this is you've got a section that describes what innovative leadership is, and then the second half of the book is, what do I do to get there? So it's a series of processes and worksheets and templates and case studies. So we've got several different clients who've gone through this process, and they, in their own words, share their experiences.
Great.
That's awesome.
So we'll have to wrap up here. What is your website, and any last comments?
The website is www.metcalf-associates.com, or you can Google my name, Maureen Metcalf. And also you can Google Innovative Leadership Workbook or Fieldbook, and the website for that is innovativeleadershipfieldbook.com. And I just want to thank you both, Sam and Kevin, for the opportunity to participate and be your first calling guest.
Thank you. It's awesome having you on the show. And we just want to say goodnight to everybody. Thanks to everyone for joining us tonight on Bridge to Everywhere. And we will see you next Monday night at 7 p.m. And this show will rebroadcast this Wednesday night at 5 p.m. in case you missed some of it and want to hear more.
That'll be 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Have a great night, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, Maureen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.